Hello and happy Friday. You're listening to Mixture of Experts. I'm your host, Tim Huang, back from vacation. Each week, Mixture of Experts brings together an amazing group of, well, experts to tackle, debate, and explain the biggest trends in the fast-moving world of artificial intelligence. This week on the show, we're going to cover three stories. First, with the Euros, Wimbledon, and the Copa America all in a matter of weeks, we talk about AI in sports. Will AI have a role in shaping the nature of the game? If so, how?
You know, they might just see gameplay, whereas we see data and an opportunity to derive these types of insights to help find the signal in the noise, to provide the serendipitous type moments that connect people to the game.
Second, a new study out in the IEEE's Transactions on Software Engineering reveals new data about GPT's performance on coding tasks. What's it tell us about the future of coding assistants?
I worry a bit about, you know, this over-reliance on AI tools for problem solving, especially as you're learning in the early stages for programming.
And then third, a fascinating paper out in archive entitled Scaling Synthetic Data Creation with 1 Billion Personas from Tencent's Seattle Lab. Does it provide a way forward for resolving data bottlenecks? And what can we use personas for in the future?
How confident are we about the coverage of these 1 billion personas? And do the underlying large language models, you know, really understand being a Maasai warrior?
As always, I'm joined by an incredible group of panelists that will help us navigate what has been another action-packed week in AI. So today we've got three panelists: Skylar Speakman, he's a senior research scientist at IBM; Kautar El-Megrawi, principal research scientist at IBM AI Engineering, AI Hardware Center; and joining us for the very first time is Aaron Botman, IBM fellow and master inventor. Welcome to the show, everyone. First, it's been a very busy season if you're into watching sports. Wimbledon, the Euros, and the Copa America are all happening basically like this week, last week. I know we've talked largely on the show at Mixture of Experts on AI as kind of an internal business process. Particularly with all the sports in the air, I've been kind of thinking that it might be a really good opportunity for us to talk a little bit about the ways in which AI might reshape sports itself. And Aaron, I want to start with you as kind of our new panelist on the show, just to pick on you a little bit. You were actually at Wimbledon. And I'm curious, as someone who works, you know, day in, day out, why did you go? What do you think? And as someone who works in AI all the time, I'm sure if your experience of this kind of tennis tournament, where you're like, oh, actually, there might be a lot of ways for AI to apply. So just kind of as an initial place, just to get the report on Wimbledon.
It's always fascinating, you know, to watch how we operationalize lots of these AI techniques, and particular in this case with our partner, Wimbledon. And I was lucky enough to go. You know, we've been doing this for with them almost 30 years now. And this year, you know, we focused a lot on generative AI. But I also don't want to forget about classical AI, right? Because both of them are very important. And we used many different techniques in order to do it. But to actually be there, right, during the tennis and being and sort of in the thick, right, of the space, it's very interesting, you know, because there's many aspects. There's A, how's the technology performing? How is the consumer acceptance, you know, of the tech? And then how's the back office acceptance as well, right? So it's always nice, right, to watch people around the world, you know, use it. You know, we get billions of users every single year, you know, that use, you know, our systems. You know, in this case, for the generative AI, just at the halfway mark, right, people spent 2,319 hours just looking and reading the generative content that we produce.
And I think if I can ask you to back up a little bit, I mean, our listeners won't necessarily be familiar with what you were working on. We'd love to hear kind of a little bit more about, like, what is the technology that you're mostly focused on this year and what people were doing with it?
Yeah, so we're looking at bringing the game in a personalized way to you. Right. And so what we'd like to do is mix in different aspects. You know, we like to rank players. We like to predict who might win a match. And then we want to create content to catch you up, right? So that, you know, if you join in the tournament, we want to create these digestible nuggets so that, you know, the consumers around the world can, you know, view and understand, you know, what's happening in the match, right? And it helps, you know, the fans, you know, whereas, you know, they might just see gameplay, whereas we see data and an opportunity to derive these types of insights to help find the signal in the noise, to provide the serendipitous type moments that connect people to the game.
Yeah, for sure. And I was talking with a friend recently about this was, so as someone who got into football, soccer, that is, you know, during my time, like in the pandemic, my experience of the sport has largely been like a visual experience, right? And it is so interesting to me that like, you know, having never gone to a game, I'm a huge fan, I watch all the time, but my primary experience is kind of like intermediated, right? Through, you know, social media and what I see on TV. And it kind of sounds like there's been a similar exercise to try to figure out like how AI kind of plays a role in that interface, right? From like the fan and the viewer to kind of get more out of the game. I guess Aaron, I'm curious, like any lessons learned, things that you thought like worked really well for this this work?
Yeah, so we used lots of different sensors around the courts to gather data. You know, so we use like a Hawkeye system that has, you know, up to 9 different cameras that track the ball, track the players. You know, we get all sorts of stats that are streaming to us, but there's just this deluge of information, right? And it's hard for people to just comprehend it. So one of the lessons learned that I think we had was to create these digestible narrations of, you know, pre-match, post-match, about the players. So they can go in and just quickly read up, you know, on their favorite players. And then some other aspects that we also learned is that sometimes it's nice to inject information that maybe somebody wouldn't ordinarily, you know about or read about or even think about. Right. So it's nice, you know, to watch that, you know, happen and spread. So that's, you know, one of the pillars. I think just very quickly, the other pillar would be on the operations side, you know, that it's always great to have human and machine and algorithms working together to create the symbiotic, you know, experience that can be used whether it's mobile, you might be on site, you know, as a fan. So it's really evolving, right, into this sort of Moneyball 2.0.
Yeah, I think the power of AI in sports really is transformative, and AI here plays a multifaceted and transformative role, especially not just on the commentary side, on the user experience. I think there are lots of different applications where we can see the power of AI here, like things like performance analysis, athlete and performance training, where with using wearable technology, you can have these sensors that collect data on the athlete's movements, the biometrics, et cetera, and analyze the data to provide insights of, you know, where the athletes can, you know, improve. Video analysis, you know, analyzing video footage of the training sessions and games, assessing techniques, identifying weaknesses. Game strategy also is also a big application here. Health and injury prevention, with doing in things like injury diagnosis. Can AI algorithms also can assist in diagnosing injuries through image analysis. Fan engagement and experience, of course, is the fun part of it. Like Aaron was talking about, you know, with the personalized content, with the chatbot and virtual assistants and the augmented reality, even, you know, you can have kind of a true immersive experience where you can enhance, you know, AR and VR experiences. Imagine watching a game and like you're there, you know, with the AR and VR. I think that can be really a lot of fun. And of course, with all the game and event management, you know, there are also areas where you can use AI for scheduling, logistic, crowd management, ticket. So lots of, you know, areas here where AI and also Gen AI can really play a transformative role. And I can only see this kind of growing.
That's right. Yeah, I love the idea that in the future you'll be able to get like whatever commentator you want just generated algorithmically on the fly. You know, like I want, you know, I want George Washington to narrate my my sports game, and to have that audio generated on the fly would be really interesting. I also think this kind of point about kind of like the back end is also really interesting about like all the operations it will help with. And I know, Skylar, you were interested in particular the idea that kind of, you know, maybe teams that will be able to like really manage all this data will have this huge advantage in the future. And like it'd be like a wonderful world where basically like, you know, someone managing a top tennis player in the future will like also be trying to get H100s to run their own fine-tuning runs.
So maybe actually two questions along those lines, both to Aaron. Do you know of any of the tennis players, have they used this? Are they looking at their narrative that was generated? So, you know, has it reached the player side? I know we're talking about consumer-facing tech at this point, but have any of the players commented? And the second one is, when is IBM going to bring this technology to esports? You know, so the data is almost already in a more usable format there, but there's can be just as much hype and excitement and drama in some of these more recent esports that are coming out. And I think there's a great opportunity to bring this technology to electronic gaming. That's one of my favorite pastimes. So yeah, Aaron, any comments on those?
Yeah, so first, you know, great questions, you know, and suggestions. I think that players actually use some of our information? And it's really funny. Some of them do, some of them don't. Some of them are very superstitious, right? If they were to look at one of our predictions, right, then it would sort of mentally affect the way in which they play the game upcoming. And so some coaches do not let their players, you know, look at some of our features. And then some properties were not even allowed to, you know, during a game to show, you know, any sort of predictions or sometimes even gen content, because it might influence, right, play as well. But on the other side of the coin, some players, you know, have, you know, used it and they do look, you know, at the stats, you know, that we boiled down. And we also had a project with the U.S. Open. You know, we worked with some ATP players and so on, where we would help them train, you know, so they would see videos of themselves playing. We would find highlights of how they played. So it was like a dashboard, you know, with the developmental center. So there's that aspect. And I was curious, do any of you play tennis or sports? And
not very well.
And would you use these kind of insights? Or
I think I would try to use, especially if, you know, maybe trying to help with my performance. I mean, I'm not an active sports person, but I hope, you know, to help me maybe improve techniques and things like that. But another thing, is there any downside to this? And I worry a little bit maybe about the bias and fairness with certain athletes. These are always, you know, flags, you know, red flags that we could have with the use of AI. The AI systems can inherit biases present, you know, in the training data. Could this lead to unfair treatment of the athletes? For example, biased scouting or algorithms might overlook maybe some talented individuals from underrepresented groups. So there are some, you know, dangers. I don't know, Aaron, if this is something that you think the current algorithms are taking seriously, or this is still early on and we're just evaluating the technology right now and maybe, you know, start looking seriously into these concerns, privacy issues, bias, fairness.
Yeah, fantastic topic that could take, you know, hours, right, to talk through. But so yes, you know, fairness, transparency, and explainability, you know, where in Gen AI might call chain of thought to understand what's output from the models. But a story real quick, you know, and tennis, we used to measure, or still do measure the excitement of videos, right? So we'll look at, for example, signals like sound, right? Gestures, score. And we quickly found out that somebody who's an amateur, right, who's playing golf, they might have a really exciting shot, but because they're not a very popular player, there's not a lot of people around them to make a very loud cheer. Right. Whereas there might be a, you know, top five ranked player who makes a routine shot. It's not that exciting, but has a huge cheer because there just happens to be a lot of people there. Right. So we take that into account and we'll de-bias with post processors, you know, based on different restrictive traits that we have, you know, because, yeah, it's real. Right. And we work to make sure, you know, that we can de-bias these types. And there's many de-biasing ways and methods. Right. And the Gen AI space, you know, we're, I think, just beginning, you know, around that. And a question for you all is, you know, we try to balance creativity with factualness, you know, with these different generative content. You know, how do you think the field can do a better job, right, at doing that, you know, with respect, if you think there's hallucination, if you're more creative, you know, whereas you need fact checkers, you know, and so on and so forth?
I think one thing that will become, if we continue to kind of collect this data, you'll be able to ask questions about how exciting was the current top star when they were just starting out. You'll be able to go back in time 10 years and look at that top star when nobody was following him, but he was still making the great shots. We probably don't have that now because we don't have as much historic data, but if you can, you know, you'll really be able to watch entire, I think, careers play out over time, at least with your ideas of the guy who's not popular now but made a great shot. You'll be able to ask that same question. All right, Michael Jordan, his freshman year of college, didn't make the team. You know, that type of perspective. But we're not going to be able to do that with the snapshots of data we have currently.
Yeah, and I am hoping that some of these tools will actually help teams kind of like see around corners, right? Like, I think some of the most interesting times in sports is when someone comes up with an entirely new strategy, right? That kind of like totally changes the nature of the game. And hopefully with data, there's like a chance to kind of identify a lot of things that we might not otherwise in the past. So I'm going to wrap up this section. I guess, Aaron, maybe a question just to throw it back to you is, you know, it seems like you've done a bunch of work in tennis, right? So like Wimbledon, US Open. And I'm kind of curious if there's like, as an AI researcher, is there kind of like a dream sport you'd really want to kind of like apply some of your techniques to, or ones that like, you know, haven't really been investigated? You know, I assume one of the reasons for tennis is like, you know, it's a lot more controlled, right? You can like set up a bunch of cameras. There's kind of a defined place where it happens. But I'm curious from like almost a CS point, like what's the next most exciting, you know, sport to get AI-ified and why?
Yeah, so we focused a lot on tennis, golf. We're doing some, you know, fantasy football, which borders on e-gaming. We did do some e-gaming with the Overwatch, which was very interesting. But I think exploring the intersection of gaming with that of a sport, you know, because I really enjoyed the challenge of e-gaming because, you know, the physics engine can change. You know, you can get new skills and new abilities on the fly. You can get power-ups, you know, so it's different. And your models have to adjust very quickly and maybe quickly online learn a new hero, right, that, you know, is transported into the game. So that's interesting. And in a real live aspect, one of my favorite sports to watch is basketball. You know, I would love to, you know, look at that, analyze more of the team aspects in play. And then also look at the Olympics. I saw an article where I believe it's NBC, they're going to be using generative AI to recap, you know, some of the matches. So I'm very curious about what they're going to do and how that's going to, be accepted, really, you know, by the population. But yeah, so that's my answer. I'm sticking with it.
There's been, of course, a lot of hype around the ability for generative AI to assist with software engineering. And a lot of excitement about the idea that at some point, AI might just do the coder's job entirely from end to end. Copilot, of course, one of the most kind of successful, I think, products of the Gen AI era is a great example of this. And there's a great paper that came out just last week in the IEEE Transactions on Software Engineering entitled, "No Need to Lift a Finger Anymore? Assessing the code quality of code generation by ChatGPT." And basically the idea is to say, okay, well, we know that, you know, these systems can code. How good are they at doing it? And so it benchmarks ChatGPT against a number of different coding challenges to assess how well it is at generating code. And I think there's kind of two interesting findings I wanted to discuss with the group here today. You know, the first one is basically that it turns out that these coding platforms have, you know, ChatGPT in particular, has this huge variance in its ability to do coding tasks, right? So it turns out that for, you know, tasks in this benchmark labeled hard, it's only able to get it right about 40% of the time. And then for easy tasks, it's up to like 89%. And I'm kind of curious, as folks on the call who all code and presumably use stuff like, you know, Copilot, you know, I think there's been a narrative which is, you know, okay, these coding assistants are basically just like Stack Exchange ++++, right? They just help you search the internet and get an answer for easy things. But I'm kind of curious if you all kind of buy the skepticism of the paper, right? Which is to say, for the really hard tasks, we are still just not seeing, you know, LLMs or generative AI be able to kind of like really kind of advance the state of the art or accelerate our ability to solve truly hard CS problems. And kind of curious about, you know, what you all think about that, if that's just a temporary thing, or if that is a kind of ceiling that we are all running into. And I guess, Kautar, do you want to kind of respond to that? I know
Sure. You
might have a view on this, particularly when it kind of comes to sort of like the coding task and it's also its relationship to hardware.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading the paper. I think it did a very nice study to evaluate, you know, GPT for coding challenges, which revealed mixed performance, like you showed. So influenced also by this training, data cutoff, and the inherent limitations of existing models. So for simple tasks, it's doing fantastic. And I think it'll continue to do fantastic for complex things. It still has limitations. You know, Gen AI today is still struggling with understanding the broader context of a project, you know, which leads, you know, to suggestions, for example, that don't really fit the overall design or architecture. So especially when you have, you know, these designing complex systems where you have multiple components, multiple APIs that need to interact with each other. It's still, because that requires reasoning, and that there are still limitations with Gen AI when it comes to reasoning. So I think the complexity of the context understanding, the integration challenges, you know, integrating also multiple components together, and then those interfaces, how they communicate with each other. So that's still, I think it's a bit of a challenge for Gen AI. So I think as we're improving in terms of the contextual understanding and the accuracy of the Gen AI models, we will see, I think, better results, better integration and user experience with these coding challenges. But I think there is still a lot of research that needs to be done. So, and things like best practices in software engineering, just as clear system design and prompt engineering, you know, can enhance also, you know, these tools. But I think we're still in the early stages.
A fun contextual story for this. We just hosted about 40 high school students here at the lab just to kind of show them what industrial research looks like. And they were asking questions with our software engineers. And they were asking questions, you know, do you use Copilot or do you use generative AI in your code? And they kind of said a little bit, but to a person, everyone down our line, it was always referencing Stack Overflow. And so I think your comparison of what you kind of really want is this kind of nice integration between the tools that we're really used to, like a Stack Overflow, sitting inside your IDE, allowing you to code so much smoother. It was a great example because the high school students weren't as familiar with this thing called Stack Overflow. And our software engineers are saying, no.
This old-fashioned thing called Stack
exactly,
Overflow.
Exactly. And that was this point where there was kind of the old and new hitting together. And those types of resources are so incredibly useful. And it will be interesting to see if these code generators, how much are they really taking from Stack Overflow? And in that paper, they made this really cool analysis. They broke down the coding questions that were before, I think, 2018, and the ones that were after 2018. Don't quote me on the date. But it did very well on the old questions and very poorly on the new questions, suggesting that the LLM is not keeping up with the most recent content kind of experience on Stack Overflow. So it was really cool to see that breakdown where they did the performance of the LLMs doing great on older established questions, perhaps with answers already sitting on Stack Overflow, and not so well on the more recent coding challenges that came up after the training. So I think we're going to see these kind of comparisons with what exists on Stack Overflow and what's been incorporated into the LLMs. But a really cool place to see it play out.
Wouldn't that require for maybe frequent retraining or readjustments of the models?
Yeah, I think it can be a solved problem. I was just giving hats off to the researchers who kind of understood that nuance between the coding ability of the models and say, wait a minute, this model was trained roughly about this time. Let's see if we can ask it coding questions that didn't exist, at least in the common, the Stack Overflow universe at that time. And then they give the performance breakdowns. But yes, retraining and constantly taking into account new information would be a way to try to address that.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the really interesting sort of challenges that it brings up because, you know, like pre-training, right? Like updating the training data is like actually kind of like it's a cost-intensive task, right? You like have these models that don't necessarily get pre-trained, you know, every single day. And so there's this kind of weird thing that the paper sort of suggests, which is that like if you're working with older languages, right, you're actually going to be in trouble with these models. And kind of the best way to survive is like you'll actually see like everybody trying to migrate to avoid being automated. To like there's more pressure to basically adopt new languages. And it also similarly, like those new languages are simultaneously ones that the model are like is not very good at assisting. So it kind of imagines kind of this like bifurcated world where there's a bunch of these older systems that AIs can basically automate most of the coding for, and then kind of this like frontier of kind of code that like essentially can't get automated away. And that has really interesting implications for like where we see, I think, the impact of the technology will be.
I think this dependence on AI, like if we have this over-reliance on AI tools, I think maybe the danger could be this decline in problem-solving skills. Is that going to be a problem? Because if especially the young generations of programmers, if for all these simple tasks, you know, they just go ask ChatGPT, you know, write a code that does this for me. And how is that going to impact, you know, because usually you learn coding from these simple examples and then you build on top of that to go to more complex problems. So I worry a bit about, you know, this over-reliance on AI tools for problem solving, especially as you're learning in the early stages for programming and as you build. Of course, maybe that's going to require new skills that we need to develop as programmers or coders or sort of software developers, is figuring out how to use these tools more efficiently and how to know whether these are kind of plausible solutions or I need to change them and tweak them. And another thing I see is, what does it mean for debugging when there are issues? If I have relied heavily on these code pilots to write code for me, and when things are failing, will I be able to debug things properly, or should I also rely on AI to help me debug these things? So it's kind of, it's interesting to see how the interplay of all these different things will come to play, and the role of humans here and coders. I think, I don't know all the answers to this, maybe if you have some insights, but there is a downside and to this, and of course, lots of advantages in terms of enhancing code productivity, but there are challenges as well we have to think about.
Yeah. I've seen in the field that many people, they'll consult different types of code assistants, you know, because there's many different models that are specialized around different types of tasks. And, you know, this agentic, you know, architecture where you have a mixture of experts, right, of which you bring together, such as many different large language models, is almost like coding by crowd, you know, in an automated way. And so now it seems like these developers and scientists and operations experts, they sort of have to have analytical capability to discern about what's the best technique with these different opinions, right? Because you're going to have many different opinions and coding styles and perhaps even languages, you know, being sent to you, right? And I think one important aspect that I always try to follow is that there's no free lunch, right? That there's not a perfect algorithm suitable to solve every single problem, right? It depends on the context of the problem of which is at hand. And so with that in mind, you know, I think the human really understands the context of their audience, what they're trying to build, where they can deploy it. Whereas these code assistants, at least today, you know a limited amount of the context, and therefore it's important to get multiple large language model opinions as far as what they should or shouldn't do, you know. And when one area that I have a lot of interest in is this automatic transpilation of code. So say you're running, you know, an application in one language, let's say Python, right? Maybe it could be transpiled into Rust, right? Where maybe it would be less memory intensive, you know, on the fly. And or you could have a human sort of look and say, yes, I agree, no, I don't agree, you know, and sort of take that analytical approach. But I think it's all emerging, right? And I'm really excited about, you know, the future and what we as IBM can also do with InstructLab, right? To use a skill building, right? In a way to help with this, as I was mentioned before, but the sort of timeliness, right, of data of which it can understand with in-context learning, fine-tuning, you know, there's many approaches, and there's going to be many more in the future.
Yeah, I think one big thing that LLMs will probably play a big role in is, you know, the average state of documentation for code is very, very poor. And I feel like the one enormous use case is even outside of coding assistance, just taking a piece of code and make sure it's like well documented will be this like huge improvement in quality of life for this kind of work.
I love that because documentation is always an afterthought and it is so
no one wants
important.
To do it.
Because you never have time to do it. So that would be a huge help.
Yeah, that's right. It'll be so funny. The biggest thing won't be like automated code. It'll just be like making sure that like someone's doing a good job documenting everything. Well, great. Well, I want to take us to our last topic of the day. There was another wild paper, if you're kind of a weirdo like me and just like browsing archive for fun. This is one of the papers that kind of popped up recently that sort of caught my eye. And, you know, the way it did this is because it basically is people doing SEO with their papers. So the title is Scaling Synthetic Data Creation with 1 Billion Personas. And so with a name like that, you know, I got to click it. I got to download it. I got to read it. And some of us need to even print it out, like Skylar here. And it's actually a pretty simple idea, but I think this particular group of experts would be really good to kind of tackle it. You know, to just kind of give the overall background, right? The idea is, you know, there's a need to generate synthetic data often, right? Because collecting real data out of the real world is very expensive and comes with all these operational difficulties. So people are always kind of trying to come up with ways of creating data from scratch that they can kind of just generate on the fly and use it to effectively train their models because it kind of like reduces that bottleneck. And so these researchers out of Tencent's Seattle lab said, oh, well, maybe one fun way of doing this is I can kind of instantiate what they call personas, which is like a personality. Could be like, you know, your job is as a dog catcher or your job is as a professional coder at IBM. And their kind of observation is, well, we can get these different personas to do different tasks to output data for us. And these tasks will generate very different reactions, right? So it turns out if you ask a, you know, a dog catcher to generate code for you, it will look like, you know, different from the code that you have if you prompt the model to say you're an expert coder. And what they kind of make the argument for is that with all of these personas, we have a scalable way of generating lots of training data. And they do a couple experiments to show that you can use the synthetic data to train, you know, an LLM to do math problems effectively. And I guess, you know, maybe just to kind of kick it off, you know, particularly Kautar with you on the line, you know, I think the big question here is like to nowadays, like how much is compute the bottleneck and how much is like data the bottleneck? Because it feels like here is the world where it says, okay, well, if you just have lots of compute, you can generate all the data that you need. But, you know, a few episodes ago, we were just talking about how difficult it is to come by compute. And so I'm really kind of interested in your take on like, what is the bottleneck right now in the machine learning workflow?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Of course, you know, with Gen AI, compute is a big bottleneck right now with all the, especially the MATML multiplications that takes a huge amount of compute with the current accelerators and hardware. Data, you know, when it comes to data bottlenecks right now, I think in certain industries, I mean, what is the bottleneck today? It depends. In certain industries, we don't have much data, especially in industries like Industry 4.0, where you have, machines and so on, and you need to understand, you know, their operations. Sometimes there is a lot of noisy data, or, you know, you have sensors, you know, and you probably haven't collected the data for these sensors for an extended period of time to be able to have enough data to train a good model, to understand, predict anomalies or do things like that. So in certain areas, in certain industries, there is this huge lack of data. When it comes, for example, to texts, we have an abundance of text right now online. However, you know, that text sometimes is not properly formatted or there's a lot of noisy and redundancy in the text. So I see, you know, both of them are bottlenecks. And it depends on maybe the industry, the sector, the use cases. So data could be a huge bottleneck in case, you know, you don't have enough data or you have tons of noisy data and you need to curate the right data, the right context, et cetera, to build the model. And in that case, you know, the synthetic data generation could be of huge help. Of course, compute is still a bottleneck, you know, especially right now with the, you know, shortages of the hardware shortage that we have in the accelerators. And, you know, this rate, you know, with these large models, you know, we have all these compute. And of course, we've talked in other episodes about, you know, new approaches to the MATMULL-free approaches or the in-memory computing approaches and neuromorphic and so on, trying to reduce that bottleneck on the compute. So I see both of them are bottlenecks depending on the, you know, the context, the use case, the industry.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, there's a reaction I had to the paper, which was basically like, well, this just makes all the existing bottlenecks more bottlenecky, right? It just turns out like, actually, you know, the great way to get data is more compute. And it's like, okay, well, it's just like more pressure. Like people want even more chips.
Yes, exactly. It's like Aaron, chicken and egg problem here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I guess, Skylar, maybe I'll turn to you as someone who has printed out the paper.
Yes.
although someone who's printed out many papers and not read them, I don't want to imply that you have read them. But I mean, have we solved the synthetic data problem? Like, how do you like this approach? What do you think about it?
I do like the approach. I think it's quite creative, and they scaled it in a way that I probably wouldn't have gone with. I've actually used ChatGPT to write bedtime stories for our kids right there alongside them. And a case in point here is they play Minecraft, and so they will basically say, write a story, but make it about Minecraft. So now you basically have just created a persona of a Minecraft player who's responding to the prompt. So we've been doing that as kind of an individual scale, and this paper has now taken it up to the billion persona level, and they're keeping track of all those generated stories in order to try to get that diversity. So very cool in that angle. But I want to spend a bit of time talking about that very important word at the end there, diversity. How confident are we about the coverage of these 1 billion personas? And do the underlying large language models, you know, really understand being a Maasai warrior? Maasai is a tribe here in Kenya. And so, yes, you can ask the large language model to take on that persona. Whether or not the generated output from the persona of a Maasai warrior matches reality, that I don't know how well they really covered. But hats off to the authors for having that idea of, let's take a generated text from all of these different type of personalities and actually put a number behind it of a billion. Very cool. We have not solved the synthetic data question yet. And I think the most obvious question that comes up on this is, how do we know that those personas are well represented in the underlying model? So yeah, those are some of my thoughts on that piece.
Yeah, for sure. And we're kind of in an interesting, and I see Aaron, you're about to come in. You know, like we're almost kind of an interesting place where it's like the only way we could validate whether or not these personas are accurate is to have real world data of these, like, you know, and so there's kind of this weird chicken egg issue, which is like, well, I don't know how validated they are, but in order to validate them, we might very well get the data that we need. Aaron, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, no, I just saw this a really interesting, you know, stat where, you know, the average human can read about, what is it, a billion words or a million words, right, in a year, right? And then these algorithms can read about six orders of magnitude more in a single month, right? They're just thirsty, right, for this data, right? And so that projects, you know, I mean, don't quote me on this, but around 2030, 2032-ish, we're going to run out of useful data in many different domains. And, you know, being able to synthesize data is very important. But if you stratify the data and so many ways, like in the paper, the danger is, are you watering down, you know, all the different personas where we could agglomerate and make them less, like prune them a little bit, because they're not really that much different, right? Because it's almost close to the human population on Earth, right, of a billion personas, right? So that's one area. But then I do think that what would be interesting to hear about would be like the notion of the Turing test 2.0, right? You know, how do we ensure that, you know, these new personas, you know, really do pass, you know, mustard, right? And that they actually do produce, you know, the transparency we need, explainability, train of thought, fairness, right? Because we are going to be splitting up data in different ways, and there could be side effects about that. So I was curious what folks thought.
I think the idea of trusted personas or pruning personas, Aaron, like that you mentioned, is very important. Can we kind of distill all of these personas into few ones that we can trust that give us, you know, the best maybe accuracy and prune away the ones, because there are, you know, billions here, as we're talking about a large number of personas. Another thing, how do we tie this maybe in a real problem-solving world scenarios or industrial use cases? And what does that mean, for example, if I am trying maybe to build a personal, you know, a foundation model, for example, for a factory, you know, failure diagnosis and so on. Does that, is there a persona there? Is there, for example, can we maybe talk about different skills? For example, the engineer, the maintenance person, the, I don't know, the, you know, the chip designer, all of those could be personas here that maybe we bring together so they can bring different skills and then kind of collaborate together in this LLM or foundation model to solve a particular problem. So it's like having multiple experts working together to solve a problem. So I think the idea here of taking this maybe to the real world to solve real problems could be profound here and have lots of implications. I like the idea of the scaling that Skylar mentioned, the diversity aspect, but this needs to be validated, especially to solve real world problems.
So final thoughts, I mean, I think it's very exciting, you know, where we are and where we're going, you know, and the combination of generative AI techniques with classical techniques is critical, you know, creating, I've seen the term floating around, but the AI sandwich, you know, where you might use neurosymbolic, you know, pieces around, you know, these generative AI pieces. Neural networks has been around for a long time, but I think, you know, one last thought that I had is that I think, you know, Mother Nature is the ultimate teacher, and we have a lot to learn from our own brains. And I'm excited about what's next.
Great, thank you. Well, as always, there's more to talk about than we have time for. Kautar, Skylar, Aaron, thanks for coming back on the show. And we'll hopefully have you for a future episode. So thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, a reminder as always that you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And thanks to you all out in Radioland.